Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And, excuse me, we're going through the Federalist Papers. We're not going through Federalist Paper 1, 2, 3, 4. We're going through the last eight. The last eight Federalist Papers were written after the Constitution had been ratified. They were really never published. They were never debated. And the content in the Federalist Papers were never disclosed to those who were in the process of still ratifying the Constitution, which is the New York State, and I believe North Carolina as well. They never promulgated them out there. But the point is that Hamilton was literally doing two separate things at the same time. He was writing commentary, empowering the judiciary to be able to do things under the auspices of how things were done in England versus how they were supposed to be done with a limited and defined powers in the Constitution. Therefore, what Hamilton did was he presented these magical doors and windows that the judiciary could open up and walk through and start obtaining power and exercising power they do not have constitutionally to start working in ways of law that they didn't have constitutionally. In other words, the Constitution never authorized case law and precedents to be used. It literally states that each case is to be judged based on law and fact. I'm paraphrasing, but this is what you'll read in Article 3, Section 2. Nowhere where they say, yeah, eventually the judges will be able to start applying case law and precedents and those types of things. Yeah, if you were in England, yes. But we created a limited and defined government, and we wanted to make sure that the federal judiciary could not run roughshod over the states, that the states' legal systems were to be honored and interfaced with. In other words, the federal government was designed to conform to the states, not vice versa. So this is why this is so important, and this is why we've changed up the ratification debates and reading the ratification debates, starting off with New York. I've never started off with New York before, and that's just because New York ended up joining, not because it was the debate was won in the debates. New York ended up joining the Union because Virginia ratified. The sentiments of New York were they weren't going to let Virginia basically have single say as the big state of the Union, you know, and moving it forward. They wanted to see, you know, presidents from New York. And I have to... I'm sure that there was one. Actually, Van Buren was from New York, and I know he became president. So, but he was like the eighth president. Jackson was somewhere from the South. He was the first Democratic president, so he was the seventh. But nevertheless, Virginia sure had a, I'll just say, their lion's share. They kind of had a corner on the presidency with Washington, then Jefferson, then Madison, and then Monroe. So four of the first five presidents were Virginians. Anywho, and then, you know, the two outliers were the two Adams, both John and John Quincy. They were from Massachusetts. So out of the first six presidents, not one was from New York yet. And New York was, you know, they were a big dog in their time as far as size and formidability and so forth. So anyway, as we look at where we are and what we've done, folks, to make it easier for you to follow and for us to kind of resync, as well as for me for doing citations in academic articles or in my writing, I like to tell you what paragraph we're in. So we've actually added the numbers to this. So we're on paragraph 10. That's what we're going to start off with today. And I think the rule of thumb, and interestingly enough, I shouldn't use that term, the rule of thumb, But we've got Sean and Tammy here. Welcome back, both of you.
Good to be here, sir.
And, so, Sean, do you know the background on the rule of thumb?
It was something about how they determined a measurement at some time in history, and it was the king's thumb or something like that.
No. How about you, Tammy? No? How about you, Tammy?
That must be something else.
How about you, Tammy? Do you know?
No. I'd have to look it up.
Okay, so if you look it up, the rule of thumb was a ruling that they kind of had in the South, and I think it was a South Carolina law, that a husband could chastise his wife in, you know, in her duties or what have you, and take her to the town steps, you know, the city hall, or the steps of the city hall, what have you, of government, and he could beat her publicly with a stick, but it could not exceed the diameter of his thumb. That was called the rule of thumb.
Wow.
So saying, you know, I think the rule of thumb is that ladies go first, maybe that's not apropos, because I think most people don't know the background behind that. So I don't want to make anybody think that we're beating Tammy with a stick the size of my thumb. So, anywho, it's kind of interesting to have a little background on some of these little sayings that we have. But anyway, Tammy, would you please start off with paragraph 10? Thank you so much.
Some perplexity respecting the rights of the courts to pronounce legislative acts void because contrary to the Constitution, has risen from an imagination that the doctrine would imply a superiority of the judiciary to the legislative power. It is urged that the authority which can declare the acts of another void must necessarily be superior to the one whose acts may be declared void. As this doctrine is of great importance in all the American constitutions, a brief discussion of the ground on which it rests cannot be unacceptable.
Okay, so he's talking about the doctrine of nullifying a law, taking a negative action to say you can't do that. And so there's nowhere in the Constitution where the court can actually nullify the law. Now, the court can inform Congress that the law that they've created is not constitutional, but that's still up for Congress to nullify. Now, I'm going to venture to say that, you know, how well Hamilton will keep in line with that, because had the judiciary been granted a negative power over the law, then they would be able to nullify the law, just like the president can veto a law. You have to have the power to be able to do that. So what is Hamilton going to say here? So let's keep our eyes peeled. That's another bad adage, but let's continue reading. Go ahead, Sean, with paragraph 11. Thanks.
There is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than his principal, that the servant is above his master, that the representatives of the people are superior to the people themselves, that men acting by virtue of powers may do so only what their powers do not authorize, but what they forbid.
Okay, that every act of delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void. How is that to be? So here's the big question. Because when Hamilton came in and he started actually asking Congress to do laws and to do things that they had no authority to do, did they become void? No. They actually got passed as law because they believed, wink, wink, nod, nod, that, oh, well, we can imply these powers as long as we can justify these. This is why Madison was constantly reminding them, hold on here. This Constitution was justified on these very limited powers, that we can only do these things as it's explicitly laid out. In other words, we cannot create a law that implies powers. Every law we create must be a derivative of the delegated power. In other words, it has to be directly associated to that. Like creating a bank would be contrary to the powers delegated. Again, there's so many different things that Madison pointed out, and yet Congress still passed the law for Hamilton, the guy here that's saying, hey, they can't do this or it'd be null. Well, hold on here. Why was nobody standing up and saying, well, shouldn't that be null? It's contrary. Well, no, they passed it. See, this is where Hamilton spoke out of both sides of his mouth. Yeah, he's telling everybody that, yeah, if the law is contrary, then it's null. It's void. And yet he knew that it wouldn't be, because the only way the nullification occurs is when the entity that created it nullifies it. They have to basically expunge it. Once that law is out there and signed, it is going to be enforced. It is going to be, you know, exercised as if it's legitimate law. Just like with the Alien Sedition Acts. This is why interposition is the process necessary to nullify the law. You first have to say, hold on here, that law is contrary. Who would write a law that would actually be contrary to their powers? Knowingly do that. Well, you'd have to be, you know, a pretty devious person like Hamilton. But the reality is, most of these legislators, they don't know. They're just taking, you know, somebody else's, oh, this guy knows, and we'll just trust him. So he's already setting the stage that, you know, this government, because this is what I tell people when I get into conversations with nullifiers. So if nullifying is a universal principle, just like gravity, then when a law is contrary to, you know, the powers delegated, then the ink on the paper would acknowledge and actually liquefy and run off the paper so that the law wouldn't exist. Right? I mean, that's this supposed way it's supposed to work, right? So we don't even have to worry about it. The ink will know what to do. And that's not the case, folks. That is not the case. It is not this mystical, powerful thing that the law all of a sudden becomes void. There has to be a very clear process of challenging and proving and so forth. These comments that the nullifiers say, hey, you know, it's contrary. No, you actually have to prove that. You have to interpose. And so nullification is the final act of interposition. And the nullifiers don't want you to know that. At least the champions of the nullification movement out there don't want you to understand that you have to interpose. You have to go through the full process. Because what they're banking on is, as long as they can convince the state to nullify the law, then they can do that. And that flies in the face of everything that Madison taught us when we went through his notes on nullification. So let's continue on now with Tammy reading paragraph 12. Go ahead, Tammy.
If it be said that the legislative body are themselves the constitutional judges of their own powers, and that the construction they put upon them is conducive upon the other departments, it may be answered that this cannot be the natural presumption, for it is not to be collected from any particular provisions in the Constitution. It is not otherwise to be supposed that the Constitution could intend to enable the representatives of the people to substitute their will to that of their constituents. It is far more rational to suppose that the courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature, in order, among other things, to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority. The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. The Constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them to ascertain its meaning, as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. If there should happen to be an irreconcilable variance between the two, that which has the superior obligation and validity ought, of course, to be preferred Or in other words, the Constitution ought to be preferred to the statute, the intention of the people to the intention of their agents.
So when the court comes along and they see something that they disagree with, it's one thing for them to say that we disagree with this, but it's another thing for them to interpret and say, we don't think. As a matter of fact, the onus is on the court to point to law and fact. Now, I think this is where it's probably necessary to go into, you know, the actual language of Article 2 of the Constitution. And so maybe the best thing to do would be what? Pull up the color-coded Constitution so that we could actually look at, you know, the language and so forth. So let me do that real quick. And here we go. So Article 3, Section 2 says this. Okay, Article 3, not Article 4, Article 3, Section 2 right there. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made which shall be made under their authority to all cases. And then this, so that's their basic jurisdiction. There's a semicolon at the end of under their authority. That is the ground of their jurisdiction. All cases arising under this Constitution. So when things are arising that are not under the Constitution or not under their authority, in other words, let's say they come out with a law respecting immigration, like the Alien and Sedition Acts. Are those laws derivative of the enumerated powers? Then what should happen is the court, if they look at that, before they even open the doors, they should say, we have no jurisdiction over this. Because the court's jurisdiction is limited to things arising under the Constitution. So what should have happened was they would say, we have no jurisdiction to rule on this because Congress has no authority to create a law that's not within pursuance to the powers given. They don't have the powers to create the law, nor do we have the powers to judge this law, because ours are fixed to those things arising under the Constitution. Does that make sense, Sean, Tammy?
Yes, sir.
All right. There we go. Tammy?
Yep.
Okay. So,
yes.
So if all of a sudden the federal government, Congress, created a law and it wasn't within their purview, by jurisdiction, they would not be able to actually rule upon the law itself. By the law's restriction, by the constitutional restriction on the court, they cannot convene to judge it because they have no jurisdiction over those things not arising under the Constitution. Therefore, what they are obligated to do is say, we have no jurisdiction to judge this, nor does Congress have the jurisdiction to create that. We would highly recommend Congress reevaluate the fact that they created a law they don't have the authority to create and leave it at that. Bottom line, though, we know what has to happen. When Congress creates a law and they move forward in trying to enforce the law, and the courts have basically said, we won't have any jurisdiction over this. Just imagine, with the Alien Sedition Acts, if the Supreme Court stepped up and said, look, this does not arise under the Constitution, therefore any types of enforcements and any case that comes before us, we will not have the jurisdiction over because this is not something arising under the Constitution. Ergo, we have no jurisdiction. So you may want to rethink your law here. But, you know, it's not our place to tell you because we have no negative authority over what you do. Ergo, Congress, you're on your own. Then the states would have clearly got the message from the Supreme Court to say, we're not supposed to have jurisdiction over these things. But already by this point in time in 1798, the courts were just, they were so bored without having enough to do, they were more than happy to open up jurisdiction. Marbury v. Madison was one of the first cases which was a huge violation of jurisdiction. They didn't have the jurisdiction to bypass. It wasn't even in the appeal case. They just went straight down and grabbed the case to rule on it, which is why John Marshall started off saying, well, we really don't have jurisdiction on this, but since we've got it in our hands, and he moved forward with ruling, and he used the same kind of language that laws that aren't, like Madison or like Hamilton just said, that are contrary to the powers, then they're void. And he made the very similar comment in Marbury v. Madison. Folks, if you read these things, you'll actually start seeing the nuances of how the courts were usually speaking out of both sides of their mouth. And they're masters at that. Bottom line, if they don't have jurisdiction, because when I let me continue reading what's listed here. So they have jurisdiction over all things arising under the Constitution. They also have jurisdiction to all cases affecting ambassadors for international law purposes and public ministers and councils for international law purposes, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, international law purposes, to controversies to which the United States shall be party, to controversies between two or more states. And then the rest of Article 1, Section 2 of this paragraph has been basically completely wiped out because the 11th Amendment took their jurisdiction of the remaining part of this paragraph away. The last part, or subparagraphs behind this, in all cases affecting ambassadors or public ministers and councils, and those in which state shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction in all other cases before mentioned. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, but as to law and fact with such exceptions, in other words, everything that they do has to be based on law and fact. Did I read anywhere here where they have this jurisdiction to start going to former cases and precedents to say, well, because we ruled this way, we have to, follow that line of thought, and we're going to bend it to this case and say, yay, verily, we consider this similar, and we're ruling in favor of a previous case. No, it says both as to law and fact, with such exception as under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Did Congress make an exception to allow case law and precedents? Never have. So, folks, they've never allowed it. How did it happen? The Supreme Court was handed by Congress the ability to regulate themselves. And so the Supreme Court granted themselves, the federal court system, granted themselves their case law precedents and all these other things. But the Constitution doesn't say that Congress can abdicate that responsibility. It says right here, under such regulations as the Congress shall make. In other words, Congress has the responsibility of doing this. The trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment. So this last part is really more on the criminal side, which Ms. Madison talked about wasn't that big and that important. So let's get back to the Federalist Papers. Let's look at actually, this next paragraph. But the point is, and this jumps out, I've got this highlighted, the interpretation of the law is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. Yeah, in Britain, where did they have the ability to interpret? It said right there in the jurisdiction paragraph, both on law and fact. In other words, at the appellate as well as the original cases that they're to judge. They are to judge these cases based on law and fact, not interpretation. Well, we think. Sorry, that flies in England. Our framers, as a matter of fact, Newt Gingrich in the 90s, I think it was in front of the World Forum or something like that, he basically came out and excoriated the court and said, hey, look, our courts are not supposed to have this type of power. The framers were very jealous and very guarded. They did not trust the judges and lawyers, which is one of the reasons why, they held back all of these different types of powers. And so Newt Gingrich kind of pointed this out. Folks, if you do your reading and so forth, you'll start understanding precisely why the courts did not have any negative authority. because then they would be able to overreach. And next thing you know, if you give them negative authority, then they think the door will swing both ways and give them positive authority. The fact that they got into the making of laws down the road was just, you know, harder for them to do, but they used the Federalist Papers. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I know I kind of rattled right into the end of the break there, but the point is, folks, that this is huge. Here we find in the Federalist Papers where Hamilton is basically handing the courts powers that never been mentioned, not even suggested in the ratification debates. As a matter of fact, when we go through the ratification debates and we start talking about the courts, we're going to actually see why the courts didn't have any superior powers over the states. Because this court, the federal court, was designed to conform to the states, not to imply upon it or to basically demand it change its legal system. The states would have rejected the Constitution had it had that assertion and had that inkling of an idea that the judiciary was going to become so formidable in enforcing and unifying the laws. That's another thing that Hamilton's going to get into here. But this is huge. This is huge. Interpreting the law means that it's up to them. Like they have this magical crystal ball that helps them interpret what they need to do. Anyway, any comments, Sean? Any comments, Tammy?
My only comment would be, it seems like a glaring omission that there was no apparatus or function to lay out how Congress would be held within their authority that's enumerated in the Constitution. And I agree with what you said about the Supreme Court. They have no jurisdiction, and you see what they've done with that, what the power they usurped. Look at Roe v. Wade.
Right. So the states and the people, they went through this in the ratification debates, how it was our job to keep them in their lane. And this is why in the resolutions of 98, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, why Madison said, hey, it's the state's job to keep these guys in check. If the people aren't doing it, then you've got to do it. So, anyway, Tammy, what do you think?
I mean, I just am shocked continually at how far this has gotten out of...
Okay.
I mean, especially in Wyoming, like, how the legislators just accept whatever the Supreme Court says as the absolute supreme authority.
Mm-hmm. Right, when they don't have legislative powers, and they, well, as we used to say in our childhood days, they're making it up as they go along, because that's exactly what they're doing. They're making it up as they go along. So Sean, if you would please, if you would read 13. Thank you.
Number 13, nor does this conclusion by any means suppose a superiority of the judicial to the legislative power. It only supposes that the power of the people is superior to both, and that where the will of the legislature, declared in its statutes, stands in opposition to that of the people, declared in the Constitution, the judges ought to be governed by the latter rather than the former. They ought to regulate their decision by the fundamental laws rather than by those which are not fundamental. Okay. And as you read this, just commenting on it, as you read this, you understand how he's trying to paint this picture that we should let the Supreme Court decide. We don't need to bother the states, the people.
Yes. And then he says,
I mean, the legislatures of the states.
Right. But then he goes, but that's why he goes down this path of going, well, so it only supposes that the power of the people is superior to both. Mm-hmm. And that's, it kind of goes back to what I was saying, is that when we are actually doing our job, the Supreme Court isn't dancing over our liberties and rights. The federal government isn't trampling over every aspect of our lives and intruding into our lives in such a way that they are today. We're the ones that are not doing our job and going to our state legislatures, and it has to start with your counties, because it's your county legislators who created, they're the parties, the counties are the parties to that state constitution. We're the ones that elect representation in all three governments. But the parties to the compact, the specific parties, are these perpetual entities. And this is because you and I didn't exist back in 1787, 88, 89, when the Constitution was written and ratified. So therefore, when we kind of look at the divine side of this, well, how divine is it when you actually go to and create the perpetual entities as the parties instead of this ambiguous we the people? Because the people had died. The fact is, they created a system that had a perpetual accountability because the entities themselves were perpetual. The only entities that don't exist today would probably be counties that got wiped out or changed and converted, what have you. That would be it. But most every state that's joined the Union and left the Union and come back, I mean, they still exist. Their state legislatures still exist. They have constitutions, and they've been delegated very specific powers. But inherent to the power they possess is their responsibility as the oversight and overlords of the government they created, i.e. states created the federal, the counties created the states, the people created the counties. And so we, the people, have to maintain that vigilant oversight over all of it, and it has to start, the accountability has to start at the county level. So I find it interesting that he came out with this in paragraph 13. Again, this is where he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. You know, well, pay no attention to that. Don't worry, because the people are in charge. All right, so Tammy, let's go ahead and pick up 14, if you would, please. Thank you.
This exercise of judicial discretion in determining between two contradictory laws is exemplified in a familiar instance. It not uncommonly happens that there are two statutes existing at one time clashing in whole or in part with each other, neither of them containing any repealing clause or expression. In such a case, it is the province of the courts to liquidate and fix their meaning and operation, so far as they can, by any fair construction, be reconciled to each other. Reason and law conspire to dictate that this should be done. Where this is impracticable, it becomes a matter of necessity to give effect to one in exclusion of the other. The rule which has obtained in the courts for determining the relativity is that the last in order of time shall be preferred to the first. But this is a mere rule of construction, not derived from any positive law, but from the nature and reason of the thing. It is a rule not enjoined upon the courts by legislative provision, but adopted by themselves as consonant to truth and propriety for the direction of their conduct as interpreters of the law. They thought it reasonable that between the interfering acts of an equal authority, that which was the last indication of its will should have the preference.
There was a time when the courts actually were involved in the law. And there was a time when the courts actually would do these things. But in this new form of government, where the creation of law has been isolated to the representatives in a republican form of government, you create a conflict when you allow the courts to have the authority over those things. In other words, if you understand what he's saying here, and understanding the republican form of government, he's planting the seed that the judiciary is superior, that the judiciary would be the ones to ultimately iron everything out for us. And ultimately, what would happen, because this, if, and I know, Sean, you kind of keep in mind the cod fishery bounties, how he talks about using the treasury or the purse of government to justify everything they're doing. And in this case, where Hamilton is justifying the court to be able to do those things, one can easily go down that exact same path of how Hamilton or how Madison foresaw that, shoot, if they can use money, then they can take over education, they can take over religion, they can take over every aspect, like, under that same justification. And that's exactly this what Hamilton is proposing here, that the court be able to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tammy, any thoughts?
It not only makes sense, but it's historically accurate.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Sean, with paragraph 15, go ahead. And you may be on mute if you're actually reading it, but paragraph 15 is the next one. Thank you.
But in regard to the interfering acts of a superior and subordinate authority of an original and derivative power, the nature and reason of the thing indicate the converse of that rule as proper to be followed. They teach us that the prior act of a superior ought to be preferred to the subsequent act of an inferior and subordinate authority, and that accordingly, whenever a particular statute contravenes the Constitution, it will be the duty of the judicial tribunals to adhere to the latter and disregard the former.
So in a sideways manner, kind of oblique, he's laying out a stage that something has to be superior to resolve the matter. Not that the courts are superior, like he said, but they are superior because they have to resolve the matter. This is doublespeak. Everything he's doing is supporting the idea of aggrandizing judicial power. As a lawyer, Hamilton knew what he was doing. Hamilton knew that he was laying the case to put these Federalist Papers into the hands of John Marshall and the Supreme Court to say, why wouldn't you use this as your justification of understanding the Constitution over all things? This right here is, you know, the best gift anybody could give the court system that is seeking, unlimited powers. So, Tammy, with 16, let's go ahead.
16, it can be of no weight to say that the courts, on the pretense of a repugnancy, may substitute their own pleasure to the constitutional intentions of the legislature. This might as well happen in the case of two contradictory statutes, or it might as well happen in every adjudication upon any single statute. The courts must declare the sense of the law, and if they should be disposed to exercise will instead of judgment, the consequence would equally be the substitution of their pleasure to that of the legislative body. The observation, if it prove anything, would prove that there ought to be no judges distinct from that body.
Interesting. So, again, he's aggrandizing the court. Now, this right here is where he talks specifically, because you can see this is really highlighted. And this is an old highlight that I have, and I didn't necessarily cut this out, because bottom line, when we really look at the courts themselves, because like I said, the courts do have a constitutional obligation to stay within their boundaries. If anybody was to do it, it was to be the courts. And yet the courts were the first ones to pop out from underneath, you know, the heel of tyranny and, you know, this oppressive holding back power from them. And so they were quick to seize it by what Hamilton had done. So, Sean, let's go ahead and read 17, and we'll continue on with Tammy on 18. Thanks.
If then the courts of justice are to be considered as the bulwarks of a limited constitution against legislative encroachments, this consideration will offer a strong argument for the permanent tenure of judicial offices, since nothing will contribute so much as this to that independent spirit in the judges, which must be essential to the faithful performance of so arduous a duty.
So what is he saying here? What are they going to do as this bulwark of a limited constitution? Are you garnering anything specific?
I wouldn't say that it's anything specific. I think he's trying to give them more power than the Constitution gives them.
And yet he kind of points out that this to that independent spirit in the judges must be essential. In other words, they're not to be conformists. They're not to be the executioners of the Constitution. They're to be independent spirits. Everything he's saying here is not nailing anything down. But in essence, he's building on this idea that everybody wants to hear, that the courts are supposed to be that bulwark, that final, you know, fortification to protect us. Tammy, with 18, go ahead.
18. This independence of the judges is equally requisite to guard the Constitution and the rights of individuals from the effects of those ill humors which the arts of designing men or the influence of particular conjunctures sometimes disseminate among the people themselves, and which, though they speedily give place to better information and more deliberate reflection, have a tendency in the meantime to occasion dangerous innovations in the government and serious oppressions from the minor party in the community. Though I trust the friends of the proposed Constitution will never concur with its enemies in questioning that fundamental principle of republican government which admits the right of the people to alter or abolish the established Constitution whenever they find it inconsistent with their happiness, yet it is not to be inferred from this principle that the representatives of the people, whenever a momentary inclination happens to lay hold of a majority of their constituents, incompatible with the provisions in the existing Constitution, would on that account be justifiable in a violation of those provisions, or that the courts would be under a greater obligation to connive at infractions in this shape, that when they had proceeded wholly from the cabals of the representative body, until the people have, by some solemn and authoritative act, annulled or changed the established form, it is binding upon themselves collectively as well as individually, and no presumption or even knowledge of their sentiments can warrant their representatives in a departure from it prior to such an act. But it is easy to see that it would require an uncommon portion of fortitude in the judges to do their duty as faithful guardians of the Constitution, where legislative invasions of it had been instigated by the major voice of the community.
Okay, so this is kind of interesting, because at this point in time, the mechanism hasn't really officially been baked into the Constitution, which is the petition. But what Hamilton is saying here, until the people have, by some solemn and authoritative act, annulled or changed the established form, it is binding upon themselves collectively as well as individually, and no presumption or even knowledge of their sentiments can warrant their representatives in a departure from it prior to such an act. Now, what I've been saying, what has to happen for nullification to occur is that there has to be this definitive calling out, what I call interposition. That's what he's alluding to right here. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, bottom line, as he says here, until we have done that, it is binding upon ourselves collectively and individually. Unless we've done that, until we have done that, that technically, Madison points out with Jefferson in the resolutions that they don't need the people. They actually have the responsibility as the parties to the compact. So Hamilton is bypassing this whole concept and saying it has to go all the way back to the people, when Madison says it doesn't necessarily have to do that, where the state legislatures have a duty and obligation to arrest the evil. Madison is clearly highlighting the hierarchy or the chain of command that can actually step in and protect the people the whole time while they're sleeping and not being aware and engaged in their government. Government can be self-protecting, or I should say it can be self-policing in keeping tyranny and bad government from prevailing. So, does this make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right, great. All right, so, Sean, let's go ahead and do 18. Go ahead. I said 18, I meant 19. I probably threw you off.
19, yeah.
I did mean 19, yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
But it is not with the view to infraction of the Constitution only that the independence of the judges may be an essential safeguard against the effects of occasional ill humors in society. These sometimes extend no farther than to the injury of the private rights of particular classes of citizens by unjust and partial laws. Here also the firmness of the judicial magistracy is of vast importance in the mitigating the severity and confining the operation of such laws. It not only serves to moderate the immediate mischiefs of those which may have been passed, but it operates as a check upon the legislative body in passing them, who, perceiving the obstacles to the success of iniquitous intention are to be expected from the scruples of the courts, are in a manner compelled by the very motives of the injustice they meditate to qualify their attempts. This is a circumstance calculated to have more influence upon the character of our governments than but few may be aware of. The benefits of the integrity and moderation of the judiciary have already been felt in more states than one. And though they may have displeased those whose sinister expectations they may have disappointed, they must have commanded the esteem and applause of all the virtuous and disinterested. Considerate men of every description ought to prize whatever will tend to beget or fortify that temper in the courts, as no man can be sure that he may not be tomorrow the victim of a spirit of injustice, by which he may be a gainer today, And every man must now feel that the inevitable tendency of such a spirit is to sap the foundation of public and private confidence and to introduce in its stead universal distrust and distress.
So here's... he gets into more of a philosophical, kind of explaining the importance of why we're doing this and that why we need this. And yet we're supposed to have a limited government. And again, when we talk about the fact that he brings in this concept of judicial magistracy, that means when you look at our heritage, that language right there means that an all-powerful judiciary, and that is not what the federal government was doing, only in those cases under their jurisdiction do they have those controls. As I said, when Congress does something that's not within their power, The judiciary has no jurisdiction over it, just like Congress had no jurisdiction to create the law. So they can't nullify it. They can't void it. But what they can say is, you know, if cases come forward with this law, we will have no jurisdiction over it because this does not arise under the Constitution. That right there would and should be what would be necessary for the legislature to kill the law. And yet, instead, because it's not that they're telling them that they have to kill the law, it's basically saying, hey, all of the states, if they came forward and said, we're not going to follow this law, you know, and you wanted to pursue this as the executive by some executive enforcement to say, we're going to enforce this law, and they come to us, we're going to say, we have no jurisdiction because this does not arise under the Constitution. Ergo, we can't defend you, federal government. That is the proper thing that they can do. They can clearly lay out their lack of jurisdiction, that they could never hear a case regarding the Alien and Sedition Acts. They could never hear a case regarding these conflicts of law. Hopefully that makes sense. Now, one would presume that the conflicts of law would actually be laws that are in pursuant to the Constitution. But when we really think about that, that's really hard for me to get my head wrapped around as to how that could happen. I can't understand how the Treasury, in coining, you know, coins, in coining gold and silver coins, how they could create a law and then later on of what they're to do and how to do it, and then create a controversy and or a contradiction without recognizing what they were doing. So in a way, Hamilton uses this term called red herrings. Now, Tammy, have you ever heard of the term red herring? If you have, do you know what it means?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Actually, I forgot.
What a red herring is.
No, but I hear it all the time.
Okay, so Sean, have you heard of, or do you know what a red herring is?
I know the gist of it, where you're making some argument that's about something else instead of the thing that it is.
Well, so a red herring is where you're right. You're kind of making up this argument, but it is designed to take you in a
something
direction.
Something that draws attention.
Yes. Go ahead.
So something that draws attention away from the matter being discussed.
There you go. A red herring to take you away from what you really need to be focused about. And so in many ways, this mastermind of, you know, this doublespeak lawyer, Hamilton, he is really doing an excellent job of proving how well, you know, red herrings and doublespeak can obviate and get everybody to think, oh, well, you know, hey, this is great. We're getting on top of, we understand these types of things, when actually it's the furthest thing from the truth. So, folks, we ran out of time. We're going to get back to paragraph 20 and the rest of these Federalist Papers before we move forward into the New York debates. But we're here, and I am here to help you. We're here to help, and we're not from the government. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.